It's the end of the month, and in my business, that means invoice time. And Harvest is helping me do it, the easy way. Whether you're a freelancer, work with an agency, or have pretty much any reason to manage projects, hours, or budgets, you should check out Harvest. You can track your time, assign tasks to teams, keep track of profitability, and more. Visit getharvest.com/strongfeelings to try it for free, and you'll get 50% off your first month when you move to a paid account. That's getharvest.com/strongfeelings.
I've been deprogrammed.
Hey everyone, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Cattell.
And this is Strong Feelings, a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism, and what happens when you bring them all together. And today we have a guest I am so excited to share with you, that is Feminista Jones. She is a writer, an activist, and so much more, and I'm in the middle of her new book, which is called Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World from the Tweets to the Streets. Which is, I think, such an important conversation, since I know talking about race can be pretty uncomfortable for white people like me and you are.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I find myself seeking out that, you know, sort of uncomfortableness more and more. And that's not something I would have said 10 years ago, because I didn't really feel like I knew enough to be part of the conversation. And because I was insulated, like I didn't have to be part of those conversations.
Yeah, me either. Probably for a lot of the same reasons as you. And avoiding them was so easy, you know? I feel like this actually connects to the conversations we've been having recently about the need to talk about feelings at work or talk about feelings in general. Mm-hmm. You know, white people, myself included, are so scared to look at race because the reality of looking at race means looking at white supremacy, and the reality of white supremacy is terrible and violent and awful. And it can make you feel guilty. It can make you feel like you should be ashamed of your own privilege. It can make you feel anxious that you're going to say the wrong thing. And those are all emotions that are pretty unpleasant. And so we're not used to reckoning with them. And I think it's really common for it to feel safer and more comfortable to just avoid them altogether and to decide, oh, no, we don't talk about that at work because it's taboo, right? Like, do you remember back last summer when we talked with Nicole Sanchez?
Yeah.
Okay, she was describing all of these CEOs she meets with when she does diversity and inclusion consulting. And she said that they would just like go out of their way to not mention race. Like she was like, oh, describe Serena Williams. And they're like, well, she's very tall, muscular, good at tennis. And she's like, Serena Williams is black.
Yeah.
Like, and they couldn't say it. They had so taught themselves that that wasn't something they could say, that like talking about race as something that exists was bad or wrong. Or even just a couple weeks ago, Howard Schultz, Starbucks CEO, thinks he wants to run for president. Please don't. He said he doesn't see color. I'm like, well, you know who does is the black men who get kicked out of your stores for not ordering drinks fast enough. That's who definitely knows what race they are. Anyway, I just feel like it is 2019 and I have watched neo-fascism rise. I have heard endless stories about like governors in blackface. And I have seen way too much violence against black people and people of color more broadly. And I'm just like very extremely done with the I don't see color or just love everyone camp. I'm done.
Yeah. I mean, when I hear people say this, I just think we can literally not afford to not see race and not acknowledge that race exists and that racism is and always has been a huge fucking problem. Like, I mean, when we don't acknowledge race and work to understand racism, people die. That's a reality and it happens every day.
It reminds me a bit of something that Priya Parker talked about a few weeks ago in her interview. So we were talking about events and she said that, you know, the advice to just be excellent to each other was a power blind way of seeing. And that's the same thing here, right? Like, just treat everyone equally. I don't care if you're red, white, black, or purple or whatever, which is like what I don't even know what that means. But that's that kind of statement is a power blind way of seeing, because the truth is people aren't treated equally. And it ignores that massive racial baggage that America and other countries too, but I can specifically speak to America's, are carrying around, you know, it doesn't change it. So we got to talk about it. And so I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you remember the very first time you realized that, like, you needed to learn to talk about race better or educate yourself on race more?
It's embarrassingly recent. That's for sure. Like, when Eric Garner was murdered by police in 2014, I remember that. And it's really fucked up because at the time, you know, that wasn't the first time I'd ever seen or heard of that kind of thing happening. Murder of Black and brown people happens every day in our country, and it's been happening for hundreds of years. Like, I almost wanted to say that it's more visible now, but that's not even true. It's always been visible. I was just less aware of it, and that's because I didn't have my eyes open to it. And while I started paying a lot more attention to what my role in understanding race and racism was around that time, it wasn't until, like, the last couple of years that I started actively trying to study and work toward dismantling my white privilege. And that just feels like it's too recent. What about you?
I mean, yes, same. I wish that I could say it had been earlier, but honestly, I think it was probably when Trayvon Martin was murdered mm-hmm. that I really kind of felt something shift inside of me. So that was 2012. And at that point, I mean, I was paying attention to race, or at least I was paying attention to some parts of race, mm-hmm. like the parts that were more comfortable and easy. So for example, I knew that entire Obama's a secret Muslim, he wasn't born in America story, like I knew that was racist, right? Like, and I was very comfortable calling that racist. But what was different, I think, after Trayvon's murder was that I started to realize kind of what you were talking about around, you know, being insulated from it and not having to deal with it. And something I noticed was how few of the voices that I was hearing on a day-to-day basis were coming from Black people. And that was like my news diet, my social media feed, and then definitely my friends and my work experiences. And so I started taking stock of that, and I think I'm continuing to take stock of that. But it was like these little steps at first that helped me just really see things differently and kind of like make it feel more intimate and real for me, like take myself out of that bubble, you know? And so I started doing things like changing who I followed on Twitter, changing what kind of news I was reading, and just like actively saying, like, this is something that I'm going to choose to look directly at. And then it was later that same year that I moved to the East Coast, and in 2013 mm-hmm. to Philly. And, you know, Feminista talks about this in her interview, but Philly's over 40% Black. And that definitely made me more aware and sort of like forced me to think more about race more often. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was really good for me.
Yeah, I'm so glad she made note of that, because I did not know Philly was over 40% Black. So I was actually just in Atlanta, and that city is a little over 50% Black. And everywhere I went, I could really feel that. Like, I could feel how Black the city was, and that was great. It kind of felt different. Like, it made me think about living here and having lived in DC, which is, you know, again, like, that city is slightly less than 50% Black. And there, in the places I lived and worked and socialized, you would not have known that.
I definitely noticed this when I go to professional events. And I think particularly in tech and design, you look around a room and it does not look like the city actually is at all. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think one of them is really around professional culture, and sort of there's a lot of gatekeeping around it. So the entire concept of what we think of as professional, like what professional looks like and sounds like and dresses like and all of that, it's totally based on whiteness. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, we were talking about this earlier, Cattell, the news last week about New York City banning employment discrimination based on hair, which is really good. That's so great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I saw all these stories from Black women who were talking about that ban or sort of like reacting to it. And, you know, there's so many stories about women who are told things like they can't have natural hair and be professional. Like, the hair that grows out of their head is unacceptable is basically what that says, right? Or just all these other kind of microaggressions, right? Like, they go to work and their coworkers touch their hair without permission. Please don't do that, everybody.
Ugh, do not.
Just stop. I can't believe that I would even have to say it, but I hear it constantly.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't even have to comment on it.
You know, that's such good advice in life.
Just
did you know you don't have to say anything?
Such good life advice.
But you know, this actually made me think about something that I think is pretty important too, which is like, up until a couple of years ago, I don't think I really knew anything about the historic or cultural meaning of Black hair, or sort of like the politics wrapped up in Black hair, because I didn't have to.
Right.
And so I started learning just like a little bit about it, right? A little bit about the pressure that Black people are under to have certain types of hairstyles, the way that, you know, they've been sold lots of things to relax their hair, to make it less curly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What good hair is, all of those conversations. And, you know, I felt like starting to learn about that was kind of connecting me to this sort of like much larger issue about like, oh, wow, I haven't had to learn very much about what it's like to be Black in America, or about Black history, or much of anything having to do with Black culture. And I was like, oh, I that needs to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I follow a woman on Instagram. Her name is Erica Hart, and we featured her in our newsletter last week. So she recently just posted this story about getting a massage, and she was trying to tell her masseuse, a white person, that she's had a double mastectomy and has lymphedema in her arms. And the masseuse said, okay, I'll just stay away from your arms. So then she was like, you don't have to avoid them, just be mindful. To which the masseuse said, okay, if that's what you want. And she was like, white people are so careless with my body. And I read this and I was like so sad. And I just was like, God damn, like, I think about what my experience in that situation would be, and it's literally never worrying about how my body will be miscared for because of the color of my skin.
It is such a sad statement, right? Like how little care we have for Black bodies. And I'm really thankful that people like her exist and share these stories, especially like she does not have to share this. Because I think it really helps to pop that white bubble that we live in otherwise. And you know, makes me get out of this place where I'm not obligated to know anything about any culture other than white culture. And I think that really started for me in childhood. I mean, I think it always does. You know, I grew up mostly in Oregon. In Oregon, people don't think about its racist past much because it's in the West and it's not connected to like civil rights movements in the South, right? But, you know, they had literal Black exclusion laws before they were even a state. Like in the 1840s, they started passing Black exclusion laws. And those laws made it illegal to be Black and live in Oregon. And you know when you would play Oregon Trail as a kid?
Yeah, wagon trains, oxen, getting cholera, building homesteads.
Fording the Snake River.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so we learned about the Oregon Trail every year in school. Like every year.
Wow.
Year after year after year. We never talked about things like Oregon being a whites-only state. Like, that is just as much part of that same period of history, right? But it didn't come up. And did you know the KKK used to march in Portland all the time, like in the 20s?
My God.
It was a vibrant organization in Portland. So now you look at Portland and Oregon in general, and it's still very white. And that's because it's been actively hostile to people who aren't white for so long. And so in that context, you know, whiteness is normalized really deeply. And so there's just like a lot of unpacking and ongoing work that I have to do. And I think even just referring to it as whiteness, like being able to look at it as a construct and not some sort of neutral state, like the world is not in this neutral white state and then people of color are other than that, right? Like even just being able to get to that place and be like, oh, right, whiteness.
Yeah.
Even that is something that you have to like learn or unlearn. And I'm wondering if you actually remember learning that. Like, do you remember when you first realized that whiteness was a thing and not just a given?
God, that's really fucking tough. Like, I remember being in school, maybe, you know, grade school and high school, and seeing kids that weren't white being teased or made fun of for not being white. And while I was like, that seems wrong, I also didn't realize that it was about race necessarily. And God, I actually remember this really vividly. We were learning about Martin Luther King in elementary school, and I was asking my mom, you know, why was he killed? And
wait, that wasn't part of the curriculum? Like, that didn't come up in class?
I mean, it did, but like, you know, obviously it was sort of glossed over, and it was, I would be willing to bet that it was not called, you know, murder, and it was sort of glossed over. So I think I was like sort of prodding her a little bit more, you know, what was the real story? And she said, well, ultimately, a lot of people didn't like him because he was Black. And I burst into tears. And I remember thinking, you know, wow, that's so fucked up. Why? And
like Baby Cadell thinking, wow, that's so fucked up. I mean, it's correct. That's fine.
Yeah. And she went on to say, it's, you know, yeah, it is. It's messed up because we all have the same guts. We have the same color blood and everything. And he was killed because of the color of his skin. And I still don't think I really understood that that was whiteness and that race was a construct until I was very much an adult. When do you feel like you started to face that?
So I think I learned about whiteness as a construct in a formal way when I was about 18. That doesn't mean I started unpacking it for reals, but I had like an introduction to the concept, right? So I did this training program for working at a rape crisis center the summer after high school. And I worked at that rape crisis center all through college, right? And we talked about race and intersectional issues during that training. We talked about privilege. I believe we did a privilege walk or some other activity like that, where it was sort of like an exercise in understanding the privilege that you have. But even though race came up in that training, it was still an organization run mostly by white women. And then also not only that, it wasn't a major focus in my life at that time. It was not something that I was reminded of very often. And so I lived in a place that was white. I didn't have to spend a lot of time thinking about the fact that I was white. And so I didn't. But I do remember a few things along the way that helped me at least a little bit. Like I remember being in this women and gender studies class and we read Unpacking the Invisible Backpack, which I think is from like 1989, but it's really about like unpacking privilege. I think that was helpful. But I also remember this other anecdote that I did learn from, but it was not quite as neat and tidy, which is, okay. Did I ever tell you about the professor I had in that class?
Oh gosh, no.
Okay. She was very like second wave feminist, kind of like shoulder pads in their blazer. Mm. Not that's necessarily a bad thing.
No.
It's not about the shoulder pads, but she was not very well versed in thinking about race and sort of the way that race intersected with gender and all of that. And I mean, it was just like not there. So for example, one day we were reading the speech that Sojourner Truth gave, which is often called Ain't I a Woman. Apparently it's unclear if she ever even said Ain't I a Woman in the speech. But it's this speech from about 1850 something. And I remember she asked the student in class to read the speech out loud. And the person she asked to read it was like a non-traditional student. She was significantly older than I was. She was probably like, I don't know, 35 or something. But I remember she was not in like regular college demographic. And, you know, she was a queer woman who was like pretty upfront about sort of like speaking her mind. She was in a different place than I was, right? And she starts reading it and the professor stops her. And she's like, no. Can you like put more accent into it? And can you like read it like she would have read it?
Oh, I'm cringing.
And what she wanted was for her to like perform
to like act it out.
Black dialect. Yeah, no. And so this woman was like very uncomfortable and was like trying to say no. And she kept being pressed on it. Like she pressed her to do it to like really like give it all of her, you know?
Yeah.
And did you know Sojourner Truth actually was Afro-Dutch? And she probably had a Dutch accent because that was her first language. Learned that much later. Anyway, so finally the student does it. And then afterward, I just saw this look on her face and she was like aghast at what she had done.
Yeah.
And I remember in that moment, it like was not as clear to me as it would be now why exactly that was not right.
Yeah.
But I do remember those little moments of being like, oh, wait, something screwed up has happened here. And, you know, so now at least I feel a lot better educated and I feel like I know what to do to keep educating myself. Like one of the things is like learn from Black women, read their books, buy their books. And also I think I'm a little bit better prepared to like hear it if I get called out. Like if somebody says like you fucked this up.
Definitely.
I'm a little bit more ready to be able to deal with the difficult parts of that conversation.
Right.
Anyway, that's why I'm super thankful for people like Feminista because the work they do is so valuable and so necessary.
Hey everyone, it's time to talk about books. Thanks to our friends at Harvest. They're proud supporters of Grey Wolf Press, a nonprofit publisher dedicated to bringing new voices and perspectives to the world. And we love that a lot. We are joined again by Yana Makua from Grey Wolf Press to give us the scoop. Hey Yana.
Hey Katel.
Hey, Anna, great to talk with you again. So last time you were on, you told us a little bit about Sally Wen Mao's poetry collection, Oculus. What do you have to share today?
Well, today I have the winner of the Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize, The Collected Schizophrenias by Esme Weijin Wang. This book, which is out February 5th, is an amazing collection of lyrical and personal essays about what it's like to live with a schizoaffective disorder. So the author, Esme Wang, who has also published a novel, writes really personally and also really in detail about what it's like to live a life with chronic illness, with chronic mental illness, and to sort of make her way through the world.
Yeah, so I have actually been excited about this book for a while because I read about it a little while back on Aro Kwan's list of books to look out for from women of color this year. So I'm super hyped about it. Is there a favorite essay or something that really struck you when you read the collection?
Yeah, so one of my favorite essays in this book is called High Functioning, and it's about how Esme uses her appearance and fashion and lipstick and makeup to as a way to make it seem like she's high functioning, to make it seem like she can move through the world sort of under disguise. And I think that the way that she describes some of her different passions in conjunction with the illness that she experiences is really, really extraordinary. I don't think it's ever been told in this way before, this kind of story.
Wow, that book is definitely on my list. Okay, everyone, check out The Collected Schizophrenias at graywolfpress.org or buy it wherever you shop for books. Yana, thank you so much for joining us again to talk about books. And thank you, Harvest, for supporting authors and readers everywhere.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Feminista Jones is a writer, public speaker, social worker, and community activist who's currently based right here in Philadelphia. She focuses on Black American culture, critical race theory, and intersectional feminism. And her new book, Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World from the Tweets to the Streets, covers all of those things. You might know her from her huge Twitter following, which is how I first learned about her, and where I learned so much from her.
Oh my gosh, me too. So one note, even though she lives in Philly, we had to grab Feminista on the phone while she runs around on her big book tour. It doesn't quite sound like we're in studio, but you definitely want to listen in on this phone call.
Feminista, welcome to Strong Feelings. It is an honor to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much. I am happy to be here.
Okay, so for those of our audience who aren't yet familiar with your work, can you tell us a little bit about your new book? What's Reclaiming Our Space about, and why did you decide to write it?
Reclaiming Our Space is my personal contribution to feminist literature and theory and history. I wanted to make sure that we could capture this current moment, which I believe is being moved forward and propelled by Black women, specifically women who identify as Black feminists. And I wanted to be able to kind of tell the story of how Black feminism, you know, had this kind of renaissance by way of social media and digital communities. And I wanted to draw attention to some of the women that I respect and revere and their work, a lot of which goes untold. And so there's going to be a lot of things in the book that people have never thought of, never heard of, names that they didn't know that they'll learn about. And I thought it was important for someone to write a book capturing all of this. And that way we are permanently in history. And it's a primary source because I also write about myself and the work that I've done. And I think it's important because we are really at a pivotal moment right now when it comes to kind of this idea of social justice and social change. And we're starting to see the ways in which, you know, social media has helped propel a lot of these movements and campaigns forward. I think it's a really important time. And I just really wanted to capture it all.
I definitely have learned a ton from Black feminists on Twitter for years now, and it's been a really important source for me and I think for a lot of people. But I'm curious, how would you define sort of Black feminism? I'm really interested in the way that you sort of try to think about what that means and sort of what the boundaries on that are.
I think that when Black women win, everyone wins, right? I think that Black feminism represents the lived experience and the framework and practice of Black women who insist upon having their humanity dignified and being seen as equal as Black people and as women. I think that it's an acknowledgement that there is a unique existence being both Black and both woman in this world. And Black feminism is the refusal to choose one or the other. It is the declaration that I am both. And I will not choose one or the other, and that all of my liberation work and all of the things that I fight for are because I am both. So I think that if we're talking about boundaries, I think that Black feminism focuses, I mean, obviously on Black women, but I think over time it's expanded and it's like acute definitions. I think back in the day we would talk about, you know, Black women versus Black men or Black women versus white women. But now we're expanding our language and we're talking about trans women, we're talking about disabled women, we're talking about poor women, immigrant women, queer women, you know, we're talking about more people than we were talking about maybe 40 years ago. But it's still Black feminism, which is, I think, has always been ahead of the curve when it comes to like radical ideas about equality.
And I think also ahead of the curve, like you talked about in the book, with regard to how it's using things like digital platforms. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit, because a big piece of the book is really focused on making the case that Black feminists are changing the world by taking advantage of things like social media and using that to communicate. And so I'm curious if you could talk about what you want people to know about that contribution and what's special about it.
So I think that whenever we talk about liberation work and movements and campaigns, whether it's the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the queer movement at post-Stonewall, what have you, you have to think about the medium that people choose, right? Or the media that people choose. And once it was letter writing and telegraphs and, you know, secret codes, then it was, you know, telephones and it was television, you know, those kinds of things. I think that every movement has been moved forward by the use of a particular media, right? Radio. Think about that. And so now we have this social media, these platforms, Twitter, Facebook, ways in which we're able to continue to spread our message of equality and our and connect with other people in other parts of the world who have been doing the same thing. And I think it's really interesting if you look at the civil rights movement, right, in the United States, and then you look at the anti-apartheid work in South Africa, the dates almost line up perfectly, right? It was the same kind of work being done in these two parts of the world. And while we were aware of what was happening, there wasn't as much work being done together, which I think would have strengthened both. But now I can go to Johannesburg and have women over there who have written about me in local newspapers and magazines welcome me into their home, take me out to dinner. You know, like, we're all working together now. So social media for us has become another way of communication to reach out to each other and build community. And one thing I'll say is, you know, I do talk in the book about this idea of call and response and kind of African traditional communication, whether we were communicated in code by way of drums, or whether we were using Negro spirituals to communicate codes or other things that we were doing. Now we are using social media as a way to connect and use our own kinds of languages and mechanisms that other people spend a lot of time trying to figure out and copy, right? So it's kind of the same thing. And I think that's what makes it so special, and that's what makes it so powerful.
Yeah. And so one of the things you do talk about in the book is things like hashtag movements as a cornerstone of Black feminist Twitter. And you told one story in particular, Mickey Kendall's Solidarity is for White Women tag back in 2013, which I remember. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, because some of those campaigns have really blown up, like, you know, Tarana Burke, Me Too movement, in ways that are both powerful, but also frustratingly co-opting. And then other hashtags have blown up in different ways. So, you know, I know that Nikki, for example, and plenty of other visible Black women online, including yourself, have been targeted with harassment. And so clearly this, you know, hashtag feminism has power. And yet I also keep hearing people wanting to write it off, right? Write it off and minimize it as not being real enough. And I'm curious, you know, why do you think that is? And what do you say to that?
I think part of it is people calling it hashtag feminism. It's like, we're not fighting for the rights of hashtags, you know? So I think that's an over. And I think that people do that. And they also say Twitter feminism, or they'll say things like that. It's like, we believed in this feminism and we practiced this feminism before any of these platforms existed. These platforms have just given us space to communicate and share the message that we have. And so when people try to reduce it to just hashtag feminism, what the hell is that? Like, I don't even understand what that means. We're using a hashtag. It's a language, right? So if we're going to get nerdy and technical, it's like we're using these computers and these platforms. These are languages. So if we're using hashtag, it symbolizes something. So we're using that language. If I go to Barcelona, I'm going to speak Spanish. If I go to Cuba, I'm going to speak Spanish. If I'm going to, you know, some other place, I'm going to try to use whatever the local language is to best communicate. This is our local language right now. These hashtags, these at signs, all of these things, this is how we communicate. And this is how we call each other together. Like I say in the book, a hashtag is like a call, you know, for people to come together and pay attention to this thing that I'm about to say and that I'm going to talk about. And when people try to minimize that and say, oh, well, it's not effective, it's not whatever, I'm like, well, you heard about it, didn't you? If it was so ineffective, you probably would have never heard about this. And yet you did. And you went through and you read the tweets associated with the hashtag, and you wrote your article talking about how ineffective it is. But yet you just gave us a boost by putting it and getting paid to write about it. So it's got to be effective in some way.
I want to talk a little bit more about some of those campaigns, because I know that there's one of them that you created back in 2014 mm-hmm. that is still going. That's the mm-hmm. UOK SIPs. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners aren't going to be familiar with that. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about what UOK SIPs is and why you started it.
UOK SIPs is a hashtag that I created, well, that I've used since 2014. And I put in the book, I'm all about origin stories. So it's important to note that someone else used the hashtag first. But I popularized it because I was telling a story about how I intervened in a situation of street harassment where the young woman was being harassed by a guy who would not let her, you know, leave her alone. And she was pushing a stroller. And I intervened and asked her, "Are you okay, sis?" And I called her sis because she's Black. And that's how I address other Black women. And so, you know, I was telling this story. And at the end of the story that I was telling on Twitter, I said, you know what, can we just, this was right before the summer, I was like, can we just kind of all agree that we're going to check on each other and ask each other, are you okay, sis? Are you going to look out for each other? Because so many times we talk about confronting the aggressors in these street harassment situations when really we should be prioritizing the victims or the people that are being harassed and support them. And so UOK SIS, it actually represents this idea of centering Black women's experiences with street harassment. Because up until then, there have been, you know, street harassment campaigns, but they were primarily white, right? They were led by women who have really great intentions, and I have a lot of regard for them, but they centered themselves. And so the images were always like these white women that are being yelled at on the street by men of color. And we're like, well, wait a minute. Black girls and Latina girls, you know, we've been experiencing this since we were 10 years old. And it's not just people saying, hey, baby, and hey, sexy. It's them throwing things at us, nearly running us over with cars, slitting our throats and killing us for not, you know, giving our phone number. So I wanted to make sure that we could have conversations about street harassment, about the ways in which we can use bystander intervention to support people that are being harassed without it escalating to violence, and to also create a safe space for women of color, specifically Black and Latina women, to talk about their experiences since their voices had not been heard in the larger anti-street harassment conversations.
And it's been so powerful. And like you mentioned, you know, it's the kind of thing that spreads all the way to somewhere like Johannesburg.
Absolutely. And it sparked conversations and action and legislative action. And I know here in the United States, they use the hashtag to track down an Uber driver that I think like kidnapped somebody or something like that. And they were able to find him. And, you know, it's not just about a hashtag. It is a call to action. And so I was calling people and saying, I need you all to start practicing this type of bystander intervention. And then I started going and doing workshops about it and started talking about it in different places and trying to teach people. Like, I want this to be real. This is not just a conversation we're having online. I want to know that in the middle of July, on 100-degree weather, and you're walking down the street and you see someone being followed and harassed, that you are equipped with the tools to intervene in a safe way and to help that person feel better and get away. That's what I wanted. And that's what's been happening. And since then, in the almost 5 years since, I continue to have people come to me and say, thank you for that. You taught me how to help someone. I was able to use this and, you know, all these kinds of things. So anybody who tries to reduce that to just hashtag feminism, I'm like, well, no, this is being used in real time, offline.
I wanted to ask about something you talked about, the journalists turn to Black Twitter as a source. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about this panel that you have coming up at South by Southwest next month called We Tried to Tell Y'all, Black Twitter as a Source, which it seems like so important right now. Can you share a little bit about that and how that message sort of fits in with what you're doing?
I have the privilege, and part of why I loved writing this book is I have the privilege to call so many of these brilliant Black women my friends. And my friend Meredith Clark, Dr. Meredith Clark, the first person to write a dissertation about Black Twitter as a community. And what it is basically is she's going to talk about Black Twitter as a culture, as a community that we can name it and we can describe it. And there is a history and there is a, you know, there are boundaries. There's all kinds of things. I'm going to talk about how we have built community and used these platforms to develop and strengthen liberation movements. Then I have my friend Eljoy Williams. She's going to come in and talk about how we have been using social media with regard to politics, right? And helping people run and swaying votes and all that kind of stuff. She's going to come in and talk about that. And then we've got Dr. Moody Rodriguez, who talks a lot about like the storytelling and the humorous aspect and coping strategies that we use online. And I brought like all four of us coming together and really, really powerful panel, really talking about, listen, you guys haven't been listening to us for the last 10 years, but now maybe you should. Because over the last 10 years, here are the things that have been happening in this Black Twitter community space. And because you all were not listening, you were not prepared. Or had you listened to us, things would have gone a different way. And so that's really what the panel is going to be about. And I think that it's super important for people to understand the influence and the power within this kind of community online. It's beyond anything that we can really even quantify. So we have to keep writing these books and having these panels to really talk about it. We're just on the tip of the iceberg of the power. So I'm really excited for that.
I will say this. There's a lot of very self-satisfied white people at South by Southwest who definitely need to hear this panel.
I'm hearing that. And I'm hearing that there's a lot of interest. Every panel that I do like this ends up being standing room only. So I'm ready. You know, I'm not even worried about it. Come get your education. Come get some knowledge.
So speaking of Black Twitter as a source, I was thinking a little bit as you were talking about, you know, people getting paid to write an article about, you know, something they saw on a hashtag. And I was thinking a little bit about the labor of marginalized groups and especially the labor of Black women and how much that labor of education is expected to be done for free in these public spaces like Twitter. And, you know, in the book, you mentioned a little bit that there are some Black women who are starting to get paid for their following and sort of becoming influencers, but that doesn't feel like a real solution to the problem either. And so when you talk about that Black women will not save you and that, you know, this is not necessarily the job of unpaid Black women to educate you. And yet at the same time, you obviously have this huge passion for doing that educating and organizing. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, how do you try to figure out what your boundaries are around that? And how do you sort of kind of draw and maintain those as you have all of these people who want so much from you all the time?
They say F you. I've kind of gotten to that place where I share what I want to share. And I maintain that while we continue to do this stuff, I just want it to be known that we don't have to. Like, I don't want anyone to expect that we are going to be the ones to teach them and how to be better. Because first of all, let's talk about, you know, the disproportionate access to education, right? If anybody can access education, it's probably not us. And those of us who have are really like fortunate. So, you know, if you're asking me to educate, I just had someone the other day, she sent me a direct message and she was asking me, you know, what do I think about, you know, so-called, I guess, Jussie Smollett possibly lying and, you know, what it does and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, I don't give any credit to the doubters right now, so I'm not going to answer. And she responds like, well, you're not who you say you are. And I thought you were about educating and da-da-da-da-da, like this whole thing. And I was just like, you're lucky I even responded in that way. Like, I don't have to respond to you. I really don't. You're writing a book about your own thoughts and feelings and asking me basically to validate them. And I get that a lot, particularly from white women. It's like, I feel this way. I want to know if it's okay with you. And I'm like, you understand that I am one person, right? And that I don't always think the same as other people. So it may be all right with me, but then you try that shit with someone else and they're like, what are you doing? You know, or vice versa. I just don't think it's fair. It's kind of like being the only Black person in the classroom, and then a question comes up about race, and everybody kind of looks to you to answer for 40 million people in this country. It's a burden that no one wants to bear, and yet it's very real. So I recognize that I had a privilege of going to these elite schools and getting this education and having access to these resources. So I do feel like it is my job to pare it down and share it with as many people that could not have access to that. at the same time, I don't want anybody taking that for granted. I don't want to have to wake up every day and have somebody just come and post up on my timeline waiting for me to teach them something today.
And I think, you know, go out and buy the book, right? Like, go spend some money to learn from a Black woman by buying the book she wrote.
Yeah. And the book is only $15. And we did that intentionally. We did not release a hard cover because it would cost too much. We also have a campaign where we are asking people to reclaim their space by going to the library and requesting it. So that way the libraries will have one or two copies so other people who can't afford it can go to the library and get it. Like, that's what this is about for me. It's, I want people to read this and learn from it and have as many people read it as possible. If you can afford to buy it, cool. But if you can't, I want to know that you could still go to the library for free and get it.
So in addition to the book and all the work that you do organizing on social media and off, you also started a new project, I think just this month, called Black in Philly. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that.
So I moved back to Philly almost 3 years ago. And I began doing work first. You know, I was doing anti-poverty policy work, and then I was doing neighborhood revitalization. And one thing that I realized was, like, this city is really Black. And I did not know that the city was nearly half Black, like 43% Black. And a lot of people don't know that. And all we ever really hear about Black people here is either the musical legends like Patti LaBelle or Will Smith or whatever, or we hear about gun violence and poverty. It's not to say that those aren't very real stories and they do need to be told, but there's so much else happening here with regard to the Black experience here that I wanted to capture it. So what I decided to do was to do a multimedia project in which I interview just random Black people in the city, people from all walks of life, all ages, genders, sexual orientation, classes, jobs, no jobs. People who represent what I believe is the full spectrum of Blackness in Philadelphia. I wanted to tell a story. The other part of that is I'm using my iPad, my iPhone, and my handheld camera because I wanted to show people the power to create a narrative or to change a narrative is right at your fingertips. So you don't need all this professional equipment and all this professional lighting and all this other stuff to be able to tell someone's story. And so with each person, I'm taking photographs. It's kind of like Humans of New York. I'm taking photographs. I'm drawing quotes. I'm posting it on Instagram and also on my website and Facebook. And it's an ongoing project. So I started, I've posted two profiles already. I have a backlog of about 15. I've already met with like 15 people. And I'm just going to keep rolling it out every week or so. Just a new person. This is what it's like to be Black in Philly for me.
Well, I've really enjoyed it so far. You know, Catel and I live in Philadelphia. We're both transplants here too, but we're also both white. And one of the things I really noticed was that it is a really segregated city. And that while I, you know, I do have like the joy of having some Black women in my life, I have Black friends, but not, you know, you don't actually meet nearly as many people who are different from you unless you really get out there and you know, make that a priority in your networking and all of that. And so for me, I feel like it's been really helpful just to learn more about what life is like for people who are living in a different part of the city from me and in a very different life than I do. So I really appreciate going out and finding those stories and, you know, sharing them with the world.
Thank you. And what I've done is, you know, it's open. And so people are spreading it by word of mouth. I'm telling people, like, I don't care who it is. If there's somebody willing to share their story with me, you don't have to be famous. You don't have to be any, you know, you can be anybody you want. I did interview Senator Sharif Street, and I've interviewed some activists and some artists, you know, but it could be anybody. Like, I just want to know your story. And what I find, somebody was asking me, oh, well, I don't think I'm important enough. I'm like, everybody has a story. You know, it's up to me as the writer and the storyteller to be able to pull it out of you. But that's, it's like my own personal multimedia art project. And I just see Black people as the subjects.
I love this. I like can't wait to see, you know, sort of like where it goes. Are there multiple ways you're sort of envisioning, you know, it taking shape? Like, where do you kind of ultimately see it going?
You know how people say labor of love? And I think for me, it is. I'm totally coming out of pocket. It's not being sponsored by anybody, which means I get to retain the ownership of it. And that way, whatever comes out is my vision. And that's really important. I see it kind of just growing into just, you know, if people are following the Instagram and sharing it, if people are sharing the link to you know, the people's profiles, that's good. I want people to feel good about it. Like the last person, the second person I put up, she's a teenager and she just felt so honored to, you know, be able to just be featured on something like that. So I imagine that it's therapeutic for me. It helps get me out the house and meet new people. And it helps me feel like I'm doing art that's not for work's sake, kind of what you were talking about earlier, this idea of like feeling like I'm obligated to educate people. At my core, I'm a storyteller. So now I feel like I actually have a project that doesn't have a deadline. I don't have anybody editing or telling me what to do. It's totally mine. And I get to get back to what I enjoy, which is telling stories.
So like I said, I've really been loving Black and Philly, and we will include that in the show notes. So Feminisa, we are almost out of time, but before we go, I really want to ask about one other thing, which is we know you have a massive online audience. I actually checked on your Twitter account before we did this recording, and it was 160,000 people, which means you have this massive platform and you can get all of your amazing ideas and education out there. But it also means you have to deal with a lot of harassment and backlash. And I'm wondering, what do you do when that gets to be too much? How do you handle that?
I think I handle it way better now than I did maybe 5 years ago or even 3 years ago, because I've learned how to turn it off. I think I've started to transition into a place in my life where I'm focusing on the things that bring me the most joy. I'm Marie Kondo, right? I'm like, I Marie Kondo my followers. If you don't bring me joy, I get rid of you. But no, seriously, I block a lot. I mute a lot. I filter a lot. I have so many words filtered, so many accounts blocked. I think I have like 100,000 accounts blocked because I do like auto blockers. I mute certain words that I know that people like to use, words, slurs for women, slurs for Black people. If you haven't verified your email or something, like there's so many people that I just get muted so that I can actually log on and have a decent experience going back and having exchange with my followers, which I actually love. I'm not a brand in the sense of like a Nike or something that ignores people. I actually like talking to my followers and having conversations. So I want to be able to log on and not see my mentions being filled with everybody wishing I was dead. You know, that's important for me. I used to take a lot of it to heart because I was very much like, why don't these people like me? What am I doing that's so wrong? Or, you know, what am I doing that is so bad that makes people make YouTube videos about me or write 4,000 word essays about me? I was like, what am I doing? And I realized it was just the idea of standing up for Black women just rubs people the wrong way. And they are so offended by it. And they take it so personally. And once I realized that I was not going to change those people, I was like, okay, I can't internalize this. And I just started learning how to filter things out. I have an assistant who schedules a lot of my tweets. So like a lot of my promotional tweets are scheduled and she does that. So I don't have to be on there as much. I'll poke my head in. And when I have things to say, I'm waiting on a plane or something, you know, or I'm getting my hair done or something, I'll check in. But I've learned that the more I stay away from it, the better. And I told somebody recently, I was like, if it wasn't for promoting this book, I probably wouldn't be on there at all, you know? And it's about staying engaged with my followers and trying to continue to get the support that I need to do these other things that I want to do. But at the same time, it's like, I wish I didn't have to at this point because it's gotten so toxic and so heavy and just so unnecessary that I'm just like, no, can't do it. Can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, we tried to tell y'all, I mean, Black women have been talking to Twitter about harassment for a decade or more. So you tried to tell them too, but here we are.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess I could say this. I just got this invitation to come, I think from their diversity officer or something, to have like this dinner with them to talk about stuff. And I'm just like, I don't want to sit here and talk to you for free and you don't do anything. Because like you said, we have been telling you all about the sock puppet account, about the coordinated efforts to harass people. We have been telling you about all of this for the longest time. The Russian bot, I called that 2 years ago, you know, and nobody listened. And it's like, we have tried to tell you this. You haven't listened. And all of the adjustments that you have made have been because of things that we have figured out or things that we have complained about. You know, you listen for something, but the rest of it, it's like, why are you ignoring us? We are the most powerful people on your platform right now.
Oh my gosh. They need to pay you for that. Like, yeah, they should pay you seriously. A lot of money for your expertise.
Oh my gosh. Feminista, thank you so much for being here with us. We're so glad that you could join us. Where can folks go buy your book and keep up with everything you're doing?
So the book, luckily, is, you know, pretty much everywhere. You can go to reclaimingourspace.com and learn more about it. I have a synopsis, some reviews, a couple of interviews and things like that. And I have links to places that you can buy it. But honestly, you can get it pretty much everywhere. I'm not allowed to endorse any one spot over the other. But I say this, my biggest endorsement is check your local indie bookstore and get them to get it, you know, and give them the support. You can go to feministajones.com as well and see where I'll be. I'm currently on tour right now, both for the book and a speaking engagement. So I am kind of moving all around the country. And, you know, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Feminista Jones. You can like me on Facebook, Jones Official. And I think that's pretty much it. you know, I am trying to be as responsive as possible. So reach out, get the book. Let me know how you like it. Share it with me on Instagram, how you like it. And, you know, I look forward to talking with you all about it.
Well, I'm definitely loving the book. I picked it up the other day. I've been reading it all weekend. And I thank you so much for being here. It's been so great to talk with you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You all, you know, keep doing what you're doing. This is important work. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Carrie.
And I'm Megan.
And we're the Vocal Fries. We're the podcast that teaches you how not to be an accidental jerk about language.
And we talk to each other and other people about ways that we are subtly being jerks to each other.
We have episodes about all kinds of different ways that we can judge each other for the way that we speak.
Our episodes cover a range of topics on language, including Philly English,
the 30 million word gap,
inclusive language in Spanish,
the word like, and how we should all learn to love it,
Obama linguistics.
And we also learn how to use the word ope.
Ope.
So if you find these topics interesting or you want to learn more,
we are Vocal Fries Pod on all social media, so Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
You can find us at www.vocalfriespod.com, and you can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com.
All right, it is time for one of our favorite parts of our show. And this week we have a fuck yeah that I know nothing about. Sarah, what is our fuck yeah?
Well, Cattell, my fuck yeah this week is a little piece of mail that I got.
Uh-oh.
I'm pulling it out of my bag right now.
Oh my gosh.
It's a greeting card. It says, fact number 119, it is estimated that a quarter of life's pleasurable moments involve cheese in some capacity. Okay, this is a greeting card Cattell sent me, and it came in the mail yesterday, and I had a long day, and I came home, I had like a meeting in the evening, and I saw it in there, and I was just like, oh my gosh, I have a card from Cattell!
Oh.
And I won't read the note that she left me on the inside, but I will say it is really, really, really sweet, and it's so encouraging, and she talks more about cheese, and so this is my fuck yeah. Okay, my fuck yeah is you obviously sending nice cards, but also fuck yeah to like sending your friends cards in the mail. It's such a delight. It's such a treat to receive a card from a friend. And it made me think, I got to go and write some friends' cards. I have some friends I haven't talked to in a while that I think would really appreciate getting a sweet card. Oh, so fuck yeah.
I love that. Fuck yeah.
Well, that is it for us today. Strong Feelings is recorded in Philadelphia, and it is produced by Steph at Edit Audio. Our theme music is deprogrammed by Blowdryer, and you can check them out at blowdryer.bandcamp.com. Thank you so much to Feminista Jones for being our guest today, and thank you all for listening. If you liked the show, don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever it is that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And hey, you can also get some strong feelings right in your inbox. Sign up for our newsletter at strongfeelings.co. And we'll see you again next week.
I've been deprogrammed.